This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today we're back in the wheelhouse, our Wednesday news roundtable, and we have an all-star panel with us today. Budget reporter Keith Faniff of the Connecticut Mirror, Christine Stewart of CT News Junkie, and our own Colin McEnroe, host of the aptly named Colin McEnroe Show. You can join us at 860-275-7266, 860-275-7266. Email wherelive at WNPR.org or tweet us at Where We Live as we talk about the news of the week. Coming up later, David Folkenflik from NPR will join us to talk about the resignation of Gary Nell. We're going to have the seventh CEO in 7 years at NPR. What does that mean for our network? But first, let's start off with the same topic we started on yesterday's show with Governor Daniel Malloy. I asked the governor, Governor, are you running for re-election?
I'm not running now, no. I'm not a declared candidate and have no intention of doing that in the near future. Those decisions are off in the future.
Why are they off in the future? Just so people
understand.
Because
I'm governor, I have a job to do. Apparently the Republicans will have a heated race, and good luck to them. And, you know, I've got a job to do.
So why do you think he's holding off on formally announcing? It sure sounds like a man who's running. Would you like a few examples of a man who's actually running for re-election? Here they are.
I think when you talk to people about me, they may disagree with some of the things that I've done. They're not going to disagree that I'm doing a lot of things. Connecticut was badly run for a long period of time. I'm not the guy who refused to fund the pensions. I'm not the guy who refused to properly fund education. I'm not the guy who allowed state government to become bloated. State government is substantially smaller today since I became governor than it was the day before I became governor. In fact, John, you can't name a recent governor who's had net job growth. I'm the one. No others of recent history have had net job growth during the time that they've been governor.
That's Governor Daniel Malloy on yesterday's program. Colin McEnroe, we'll start with you. I'm the one. This is the takeaway quote, I think, from yesterday's program.
Well, John, I'd just like to say that I inherited this question from other panelists on this show, people like Keith, people like Christine, people like Bill Curry, Mark Pasniokas. I inherited this question. I'm prepared to deal with it, but I didn't create it.
So good. Christine, perhaps you might want to jump in. Boy, he sure sounds like a guy. He sure sounds like a guy who's running for re-election, doesn't he?
No, I think that he's definitely running for re-election. The top Democrats in the party that I've spoken to, I mean, there's nobody sitting in, on the bench. There's nobody to come up and run for the Democratic Party if Malloy doesn't run. And I think that his personality, I think that he would feel that he was a failure if he didn't run again.
Keith?
Yeah, I think it's clear that he's running it, and there's really nothing that unusual here. I mean, the front runner in the polls on the Republican side, Tom Foley, it's been no secret. The guy never really stopped running, and he technically hasn't declared. You position yourself, you announce when it's the best for you to do so. All he's going to do if he announces now is invite more criticism from the Republicans than he's already getting. There's no reason to announce now.
So, Colin, though, I think that one of the things that we've sort of struggled with over the course of the last year is it seemed as though Malloy started to wean himself off of this narrative that everything that he talked about started with what John Rowland and Jody Rell had done before him. And in this seat that you're sitting in right now, he had really stopped talking about that. Yesterday, again, and in recent months, I think, he started to talk about what he inherited once more. Good strategy, bad strategy for him?
Well, I mean, I think you can mention it, and there's some truth to it, too. I mean, government was substantially dysfunctional under Rowland and under Rell, and I think it's easy to forget how bad government got, particularly under Rowland. On the other hand, you can't make it a central theme, which is what it was yesterday. It was just a huge, huge trope that he just kept hammering home until it did start to sound more like an excuse and less like an explanation. And you don't want that. So in that sense, I don't think it's successful. One thing I'd ask Christine and Keith, too, they know more about this than I do. It seems to me one reason that Malloy might delay his campaign to the last possible minute is we don't really know, or maybe we do, whether or not he'll be publicly financed again or whether he has a different way of financing his campaign this time. If he does, that opens him up to a whole series of other questions which he'd probably rather not answer.
Christine?
You know, he hasn't said whether he's running as a publicly financed candidate yet, but he, you know, I think that he's gearing up towards that. I think that it would be a mistake for him not to do it since he was the first governor elected under the system. And he's also changed the campaign finance system to give himself a little leverage by allowing the party to contribute money to him.
That's the key, what she said, the last point, which is on paper, he will be a publicly financed candidate. But we're turning the rules, changing them into this hybrid system where you can leverage private money you need to counteract Tom Foley. I agree with Colin's premise. It still raises a bunch of questions, things that they're not ready to talk about. I wanted to just quickly go back to the first point Colin raised, though, which is how does the governor handle this? You know, I inherited it, because he's going back to it more. I think part of the problem is, yeah, it is truthful. It was not the typical inheritance. It really was bad. But also, there's this conspiracy of silence you get in every election where the candidates don't like to talk, believe it or not, in specifics about the problem, because then they have to talk about how they want to fix it. Nobody wanted to talk in 2010 about raising taxes and the like. Unfortunately, the point doesn't get hammered home to the voters just what a heaping crater of a mess. I'm mixing my metaphors. What a fiscal flaming bag of duty was left on the state's porch. And now he's scrambling to remind everyone, you know, once again, this is not your typical inheritance.
And I think that's one of the things that we've talked about a lot, and a point that needs to be made, Keith, is this idea that because there may be some questions about the way he's tried to fill this hole, about some of the tricks and gadgets, and we'll talk a little bit about what the deficit is actually moving forward, maybe some of the obfuscation. It does get around the fact that really he inherited something that is generational. It's going to take a long time to dig out of a hole that big. That's why I think he's probably back hammering it home.
That's a good point, because the more he hammers home what he inherited, it also draws attention to what he's leaving for the next term. And I don't think he's found equilibrium yet in that message.
But at what point do you own it, Colin? It's a President Obama question, too. At a certain point, you own the problem. You are the problem in a lot of people's minds, at least people who follow politics as closely maybe as we do. Maybe the general public doesn't care as much.
Yeah, I think at a certain point you start talking about, as Keith has just suggested, what you've done as opposed to what a big fiscal flaming bag of duty was left for you. You know, and he tried to sort of fuse those two things yesterday, but so much of it goes to temperament. You know, Christine said that he would feel like a failure if he didn't run again. So much of this is about Malloy's temperament, and his temperament has to do with being badly misunderstood his entire life and being underestimated and defined in inappropriate ways. And he's still fighting with that. So it's almost impossible. I mean, it would be a better strategy to say, look, I did this, 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 you know, and not so much make it this huge corrective effort from the, you know, the kids in the playground who are bullying him in the past, and they've kind of turned into Roland and Rel and people like that in his mind. He'd be better off not talking about that. But I don't think he can stop himself. I think that's who he is.
Christine, as someone who deals with him all the time, what do you make of Governor Malloy's temperament these days? I mean, he's obviously someone who works very hard. He doesn't ever want to get out of the spotlight. Before the show yesterday, he said, go on vacation. And I was like, no, I don't really go on vacation. He got away for a couple of days. I mean, this has been the narrative of his entire campaign and now his entire tenure as governor. Is he changing at all? Is he starting to get more uptight? His temperament changing in any way?
No, he's not really changing in any way. I think that in 2010 on the campaign trail, we saw a Malloy who was a little bit more open and more personable with people. And I think that he's going to need to get back to that, and he's not there yet.
We're talking with Christine Stewart from CT News Junkie, Colin McEnroe from The Colin McEnroe Show, and Keith Fanna from the Connecticut Mirror. We're here in the wheelhouse talking about the week's news, trying to pull apart some of the threads of our conversation yesterday with Governor Malloy. If you have thoughts or questions, maybe things we didn't get to with the governor, we'll raise some of those in a moment, 860-275-7266. We did talk about the budget deficit that he is facing. We had a couple callers who were worried about that. Let's listen to a bit of Governor Malloy talking about whether or not he might have to raise taxes to fill this hole.
No, first of all, I don't think there's going to be a deficit. We are in the process of doing things to make sure that there won't be any deficits. I'm very proud that we closed last year with a surplus when everyone said there would be a deficit there. I think things are looking good. I think the economy is looking better. So, I don't think there's going to be any need or any reason to raise taxes in the future. I think that the state is on a pretty good footing at this point.
So, Keith Fanna, let's explain exactly what Governor Malloy is talking about. He he's saying he's not going to expect a deficit in the next year. That is not what we've been hearing. Let's just put it that way.
Right. There was a little bit of spin in that answer and a little bit of campaign strategy he tipped his hand on. First, the spin. The governor never mentions, because it's not to his advantage, it's illegal to end the fiscal year in Connecticut with a deficit. I guarantee you we won't, because if we have one, the treasurer by the Constitution has to go out and borrow the money. So, of course, there won't be a deficit. All the deficits we deal with, including the one he talks about inheriting, are projected deficits. And guess what? Projected deficits still lead to tax increases, painful spending cuts, gutted social programs. Projected deficits are problems. So that's one thing. As far as the political strategy, I think it's very similar to 2010. We had a big deficit in 2010. Tom Foley said, I'll solve it without raising taxes. Candidate Dan Malloy staked out the territory just to the left of that. He said, well, I'm going to make that the last resort. I'm going to try to avoid it, but he didn't draw a line in the sand. Early on, 4 years later, you've got John McKinney saying, I'm going to try to cut taxes. That's kind of wishful thinking, at least in the first year. So Governor Malloy is now saying we won't need any tax hike. He's just sort of staking out the center ground just to the left of the Republicans.
Colin?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right. And I think what you won't see him – I think you won't see him say anything stronger than that. And I think you won't see him give the Republicans anything to beat him up with in between now and that election. No matter what it takes, I don't think there'll be a tax increase.
Of course, one of the things that Republicans have been trying to beat up the governor on is the number of jobs created in the state. We just got some jobs numbers the other day. I know both Keith and Christine have been taking a look at this. I mean, what do you see as the outcome right now for the governor in slightly better jobs numbers in some ways, slightly worse jobs numbers in other ways? It depends on how you read them.
Yeah, it really does. I mean, you know, they're adjusted month to month, so we could go back and we could lose some jobs that we thought we gained in July. And there's also more, you know, more workers getting into the market. So the unemployment rate has gone up. And, you know, I think the economy is going to be a big factor in his reelection, whether it turns around in time or not.
What do we see in these jobs numbers, Keith?
Yeah. This is an example of where Colin said the governor is going to have to do more than talk about what he inherited. He's going to have to show what he's done. He's trying to say in some cases the glass is half full. The problem is he's also – sometimes the administration is very aggressive in framing the message. They're saying, well, hey, everybody, we gained almost 12,000 new jobs. We also saw our unemployment rate go up because more people entered the workforce than there were jobs. Also, I talked to two economists this week who both said those job number projections are too aggressive, that actually represents 7% of all the jobs created in the nation, if those numbers are true.
If the numbers are true, what you're saying is if those numbers are right, it's 7% of all the jobs in the entire country accrued to Connecticut in 1 month.
And Connecticut only has 1% of all the jobs in the United States.
That seems unlikely. Yes.
7% of the new jobs. And even when you put the governor to the test yesterday and asked him, are those numbers going to hold up? Because labor departments are notorious for adjusting them a few months later, the governor said, well, I don't know if they'll hold up, but the trend is what counts. It's good. He's definitely trying to put the best face on the economy.
I want to get to a few things that we didn't talk to the governor about yesterday. And there were so many things that we wanted to talk to him about, but we only have an hour or so. One of them, Colin, is one of the ways he's come up with to raise money. We're not exactly sure how much money, but we're starting to learn a little bit more about the game Keno coming to Connecticut. We're going to have 1,000 Keno halls in the state, or parlors, or whatever they're called?
Well, maybe. I mean, and if we are to believe what's being reported now, nobody knows. And this is sort of... I had conversations on the air with various state officials about this earlier in this process, and nobody knows was the prevalent answer. And I mean, this is government at its worst. It has everything that's wrong right there. First of all, Keno's a bad idea for about 82 reasons, which we don't have time to go into. On top of that, you've got a significant policy initiative that's being run by a quasi-public, the Connecticut Lottery Corporation, which is not as answerable and as askable by the press or anybody else as a government agency. That's not good either. So it's hard to get any information out of them about what they're doing. And the legislators are saying, well, we don't know. And it's like, you passed it. What do you mean you don't know? But it appears that nobody knows. Larry Caffaro is pushing this kind of conspiracy theory that it was never going to happen anyway, which will be a source of great annoyance to the Scientific Gains Corporation and their lobbyists, if that turns out to be true. But he's sort of saying, no, this is just a way to balance the budget and everything. They're never even going to do it. I personally am finding that kind of hard to believe. But what I do believe is they've got no freaking clue. They did this in the middle of the night. They did it, in fact, to dump some more theoretical money into the budget, but they don't really know how to implement it.
Well, and as you asked, you know, where is the money coming from? How much money will this actually make? Nobody actually knows the answer. So when we see a number like 1,000 Keno parlors across the state, we don't have any real answers. One way to view that from the general public, Christine, is, wow, where are they going to be? Are they going to be in my neighborhood? Are we going to start to have some sort of backlash? Because I think about 60% of the people in the state don't like the idea in the first place.
They're going to be in restaurants. They're going to be in bars. They're going to be, you know, wherever, you know, convenience stores is another location
for
them.
We might want to have one in the lobby right here at WNPR. It could happen. But anyway, please continue.
But they, you know, they also don't have an agreement with the tribes yet. So they have an agreement in theory over here with one of the tribes, but there are two Indian tribes in the state, and they don't have an agreement with the other one. So there's nothing concrete moving forward. Nobody really knows where to go with this. And, you know, it – I don't know. It's $3 million – what was it? $3 million in revenue the first year?
It was $3 million the first year and maybe $30 million moving forward, but with no real ideas to where that money's coming from. We see this now happening at around the same time, Keith. We see these numbers coming out. Well, the state for the first time in a long time is making more money off the lottery than they are off the slot revenues at the casinos. So this is changing a little bit. It seems as though people are a little less likely to go spend a lot of money to go to a casino and do lots of things aside from just pull slots. They're gambling close to home. Keno seems to play right into this. Are we picking up on some sort of changing idea about how we gamble in the state?
We might be, but the problem with all three of you people is you focus too much on the state budget. You guys are obsessed with the state budget. Give it a rest. There's a political angle that you're missing here. What I think they're going to do with Keno is they've got all the pieces positioned, and now they're going to watch. And we'll watch the polls, because if you look at past polls, people haven't warmed to the idea of Keno. It might be a choice between two unpleasant situations, which is one, going to Keno, or two, in December or February, having another budget deficit mitigation vote with Tom Foley and Mark Boughton and John McKinney in the building screaming how we're going to, for the radio, I'll say, heck in a handbasket. If it's down to that choice, then there might be Keno. But if not, politically, they might just sit tight and say, you know, we're still negotiating with the tribe, or if really it looks like it's becoming a campaign issue, they'll dump Keno and say, we didn't need it. But it could all very well depend on how Wall Street's doing.
Is this plausible, Colin?
It's as plausible as anything else. You know, they certainly haven't treated it the way that they would treat something that they were completely serious about, that they were committed to 100%. So Keith's argument, I think, you know, makes a certain amount of sense. That they're not doing the homework that they would ordinarily do if they were really going to implement this stuff and get the money flowing as quickly as possible, right? If you want that money, then you get everything in place as fast as you can. You get Keno and Chuck E. Cheese, so, you know, tomorrow.
I should have added, because I agree with Colin, you won't see taxes before the election no matter what. After, totally different story. So if you had to choose between Keno and taxes before the election, that's not even a choice. You know, there'll be Keno and Chuck E. Cheese. There'll be Keno here in the building, you know.
Barney Keno.
There'll be Keno in the ice cream trucks playing the little jingle. But it may not happen at all.
We've got to take a break. Keith Faniff, he's budget reporter for the Connecticut Mirror, who's obsessed with politics, not the state budget for some reason. He's also used heck and duty on the show so far, so we'll see if we can keep Keith in line. Christine Stewart is here from CTNewsJunkie.com. Colin McEnroe is here from the Colin McEnroe Show. We'll get to some other topics that we didn't touch with the governor yesterday. We will also talk about New Haven politics and Stamford politics coming up in this next section of The Wheelhouse on Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosk. Today it's our Wednesday news roundtable, The Wheelhouse. And we're also on CTN, the Connecticut Network. Keith Faniff joins us from the Connecticut Mirror. Colin McEnroe from the Colin McEnroe Show. Christine Stewart from CTNewsJunkie.com. In just a moment, we'll be hearing a little bit about what's going on in Stamford, some interesting politics and also land use questions happening in Stamford. But Colin, before we get too far away from Governor Malloy and his run for reelection, we have been noticing something interesting. You've been writing a bit about Mark Boughton, who's jumped into this race. the Danbury mayor, the latest Republican to jump in. It seems as though, even though the governor is not necessarily officially running for reelection right now, anytime anyone decides they're going to jump into the race, there seems to be a real effort by the Democratic Party to talk about that person.
Yeah, I mean, I think sort of even though he's not running and even though Roy Ocogrosso is no longer on his staff, there is sort of an Ocogrosso-style hammer strategy. And basically what they're trying to do is make running for governor into some kind of Old Testament crime for which you are stoned and beaten with switches. So you have like Mark Boughton, you know, he doesn't get all the way through his press conference. He'll say, you know, I'm forming an exploratory committee to run for and, you know, we immediately get a press release, all of us sitting here at the table from the state central committee saying, does anybody have any idea what a loser Mark Boughton is? He didn't even get the word governor all the way out of his mouth before he's being attacked. And, you know, I wonder about this. I wonder about this. You know, it's sort of war room Carville style stuff, but it's just amped up and caffeinated to a point where it's really kind of unattractive and defensive. I think if the press were more powerful, and I think we are less powerful than we used to be, it would be a bad idea. I don't know if it's going to hurt him that much because I just don't know how much our ability to sort of reflect on that and incorporate that into our coverage is going to reach the average person. But it does come across as, you know, I mean, it's like, you know, the New Orleans Saints bounty thing or something. It's just like, you know, take him out. Take him out before he gets all the way through his announcement.
Well, and you mentioned Roy Ocogrosso, who does not officially work with the governor anymore. Tucker Ives just tweeted this out, this series of back and forths on Twitter. Mark Boughton, who is very well known for his unusual Twitter style, and Roy went back and forth over the course of a day or so. Colin, and it's actually kind of a little bit painful to read.
It
after
is.
The fact.
It's like Roy at one point had a hashtag, don't be a baby. You know, how old are we?
Well, just quickly before we move on from Mark Boughton, though, what can you say about Mark Boughton? We've talked about him on the last couple weeks' wheelhouse. It just seems as he's a compelling figure in this race.
Yeah, I mean, I think what you're going to see from the Republicans is perhaps accepting Tom Foley for a second, a kind of charm offensive. You know, I mean, Boughton has kind of a quirky charm that I think didn't come through in his glorious participation in the last election as Tom Foley's running mate. But he's funny, he's quirky, he's a little bit different. He affects these hysterical hip-hop personae. I'm not quite sure I understand what that's all about.
He has an entourage.
You know, and McKinney is Mr. All-Around Nice Guy. I think one of their ideas, basically, is that Malloy often does come across as quite abrasive. In fact, he mainly comes across as quite abrasive. And maybe to run somebody against him who has a little bit softer style and a little bit more winning style, either the quirkiness of Boughton or, as I say, the kind of Boy Scout qualities that McKinney evinces might be a good strategy.
Well, you know what? Connecticut voters tend to not like self-funders, and Tom Foley would be a self-funder. And even though he came close in the 2010 election, there might be some backlash with Mark Boughton in the race against that.
What about John McKinney? John McKinney's got some money.
John McKinney does have some money. So, you know, I think that he's viewed as somebody who is not exactly middle class, but he's going to be using the public campaign finance system.
I want to talk about some politics in the cities. Just yesterday on Colin's program, he was talking a little bit with Paul Bass from the New Haven Independent about the mayoral election happening in the Elm City. Let's listen to a bit of Paul.
What's different about this race is there are four real candidates. You don't usually see that in an election. There are four people who could serve as mayor, who are respected, responsible people, who have constituencies in town.
So you talked a bit with Paul about some of the big issues and some of the big personalities. One of them, of course, the leading candidate right now, State Senator Tony Harp. Let's listen to Tony Harp at a rally that was attended by Governor Malloy when he made an endorsement of her.
I think that together we can make Connecticut an example for this country about how we solve urban problems, about how we make streets safer, about how we eliminate the achievement gap, about how we bring jobs to our urban areas and our urban people.
So that's Tony Harp. And yesterday, Paul Bass made a case that even though Tony Harp got this endorsement, she's clearly the front runner. This is not a done deal for her in New Haven.
No, I think it's a highly competitive election. I mean, and it should be. And I think that's really great after, you know, the 142-year reign of John DeStefano. And let me just say a couple of things about just quickly about all that, too. First of all, and Keith and Christine have much more expertise about this, but obviously Malloy's endorsing Harp partly because she's in the room with him all the time. When I mean, whatever these wacko Keno deals are, and things like that. He's got to have her cooperation. But if he didn't endorse her and she didn't win, that would be a nightmare to have her go back as head of a probes and he didn't help her at all. That would be a nightmare. And if she does win and he didn't endorse her, that would be a little bit less of a nightmare, but still a nightmare. Because one thing Malloy would like to have, particularly when he's running next time around, is a mayor of New Haven who likes him. And just back to that sort of abrasive hammer your opponent style, we've all seen people patch up political quarrels, particularly if they're some from the same party. There's almost no wound or rift that can't be healed. But when they put John DeStefano in a dress for no reason that I could – I mean, I didn't even get it. It didn't really make any sense. But they depicted John DeStefano several election cycles ago as in a dress, and he never got over that. He never stopped hating Malloy. I think Malloy would really like to have a mayor of New Haven who likes him. And so he's obviously trying to play it that way.
I was just going to say that New Haven obviously brought the votes in the last gubernatorial election for the governor, really turned out, so it was important to him.
I want to turn to Neil Vigder. He joins us by phone right now. He's been covering the race in Stamford for mayor for the Stamford Advocate and the Connecticut Hearst newspapers. One of the reasons we want to turn to you, Neil, is, well, look, we've been talking an awful lot about New Haven, but there's certainly been some stuff written by you and others that it's a little surprising that while he works with Tony Harp all the time in Hartford, he also works with William Tong, and he hasn't made an endorsement yet in that race. Why not?
Sure, John. Good morning. Thanks for having me on. People are wondering, where is the governor in Stamford? And I think in a perfect world, he probably would like to endorse William Tong. He's certainly closer with Tong than he is with David Martin, who serves on the Board of Finance. But if you look in the Democratic City Committee in Stamford, Martin got the endorsement pretty handily in July. I know that the governor's brother, who is the Democratic Registrar of Voters in Stamford, is supporting Tong. And despite this kind of quiet effort to support Tong in the city committee, Martin still prevailed with the endorsement. And, while the governor is close with Tong, he's not a lock. And it's a 50-50 proposition at best. And so I am not sure that he wants to kind of stick his neck out there at this point and risk having Martin win the primary.
Let's actually listen to Governor Malloy in yesterday's Where We Live talking about William Tong.
Listen, there's no doubt that I have a close working relationship with William Tong. I think he did a great job on the mortgage bill. Was proud to go down and sign that bill in Stamford. I have a close working relationship with the chairman of the banking committee. He's done outstanding work. He's a fine young man. And I'll cross those bridges when I get to them.
I'm wondering, Neil, if you can talk about William Tong, because he went from being someone that nobody across the state knew to someone who, as Colin McEnroe coined, had Tong fever running across the state. He's kind of a rising political star, but yet can't really seem to get the sort of traction that a lot of us might think in this mayor's race.
Sure. He obviously ran for Senate, that was in 2012, and people kind of saw it as, well, this is just kind of him laying the groundwork for kind of his future political ambitions. For some reason, he just hasn't seemed to have caught on with the kind of establishment of the Democratic City Committee. Now, we'll see what happens on September 10th with the primary. Another thing that I've heard on this is that, while Governor Malloy is still, supremely popular in Stamford, where he was mayor, the state, there has been some pushback with this whole Harbor Point Bridgewater Associates, the world's largest hedge fund, is moving from Westport to Stamford, is getting $115 million in state aid. There's an 80-acre development in the south end of Stamford, and a marina was basically demolished there. And there's been some pushback from folks in the city towards the state and towards the administration in terms of how this project is proceeding.
And I know, Keith Faniff, this is something the Connecticut Mirror has been covering along with us here at WNPR. This Bridgewater project is something we've asked the governor about an awful lot. I think it has some resonance for people in Stamford who just don't like this project. It's also something that a lot of people around the state are questioning. Do we need to give, Keith, this much money to the world's largest, richest hedge fund?
It's one of the positions of the governor that's going to be very sensitive for him in this next election. I mean, there were people going back to 2010 who thought that he would be doing more to tax the wealthy. They weren't. Some people in his party weren't comfortable with statements with, I don't want to punish people for their success. And then when they've seen both what's going on with Bridgewater and what's happened even with First Five, some people think there's a little too much corporate welfare going on. And that is something that could eat into his support in the urban centers that Christine pointed out pushed him over the top in 2010.
Neil, before I let you go, another story that came out that I asked the governor about, and this is kind of interesting. You know, we're waiting to see whether or not Bridgewater gets this enormous development built right on the waterfront, lots of state money, and just a ton of new space being built. Meanwhile, Pitney Bowes has been in Stamford forever. They're getting out of Stamford, and they're leaving behind about 450,000 square feet in office space. Is this worrying people in the city?
Definitely. I mean, Pitney Bowes is, kind of an anchor business for the city of Stamford. It's been there since 1920. Arthur Pitney, Walter Bowes. Their headquarters was about almost half a million square feet in the south end, right next to where Bridgewater Associates is basically going. And Pitney Bowes, they've had struggles with the economy, so they sold their headquarters. And, in 2007, they had 1,200 employees in Stamford. That figure's down to about 550 now. And they are looking to move those employees to their facilities in Shelton and Danbury, and they're exploring their various avenues for new headquarters. Stamford is a contender. Danbury is, trying to make a play for Pitney Bowes, and you can bet your bottom dollar that Mark Boughton would certainly love to grab Pitney Bowes away from Governor Malloy's home city. Westchester County's in the mix. I know that the state economic development commissioner Catherine Smith has said that the state is certainly willing to offer incentives to Pitney Bowes to keep its business here in Connecticut.
Neil Vigder is a political reporter for the Connecticut Hearst newspapers, including the Stamford Advocate. Thanks for joining us, Neil. I appreciate it.
Thanks, John. Have a great day.
You too. But before we get to our next break, a few more things we didn't get to with the governor yesterday. One, Christine, that we've been covering on the show here. You know, we're getting ready for this medical marijuana rollout. A very small number of people so far have actually signed up to be users of this program. Mm-hmm. They're still vetting the entire process for who's going to be a producer. Now, there are a lot of questions about the legality of this. Maybe you can talk through this.
Well, there's not as many questions. The Department of Consumer Protection is in charge of writing the regulations. The legislative commissioners had some questions about some of the regulations they were going to propose. And I think that they feel that they've answered them and they're ready for next Monday's meeting or the August 27th meeting regarding these regulations. They postponed three times already, changing marijuana from a Schedule 1 to a Schedule 2 drug. So they are expected to do all of this on August 27th.
I know something you've been watching, Colin, as we all have, in the Hartford Current. John Lender's been doing a series of stories about summer jobs for the kids of state workers, like 56 summer workers at the state DOT of the same last name as full-time DOT workers. A recent story about the inconsistencies in the hiring policies. Is this something we should be maybe, as you were talking about the power of the press, maybe watching a little bit more closely?
Yeah, just before I see anything about that, I just want to take note of how much the governor enjoyed talking about Pitney Bowes with you yesterday. That you got about that question about halfway out, and you got one of those, wait.
it was an enjoyable part of
yesterday. That building was one quarter full. All right, so anyway, to me, there's a couple of things going on here. One of them is, we talked on this show and other shows about the governor's perhaps not entirely wise kneecapping or attempting to kneecap some of these watchdog agencies. What you now have here is a state ethics commission that's unable to say dispositively that it's wrong to hire for summer jobs your relatives. this just, I mean, this whole kabuki thing where they're doing a survey of all the different state departments, like what's your policy? Can you hire your uncle? I mean, why are they doing that? Why don't they have a policy? Why don't they have a policy that says, no, you can't hire your relatives for summer jobs? I mean, that's sort of a basic anti-nepotism policy. And instead, they're sort of stringing this thing out. I kind of liked the lottery idea that came up in Linder's story, the idea that, and I guess New York State does this, maybe that's a way to deal with all this. But the first thing you do is just make a rule. This is a simple rule. You can't hire your relatives. It does lead, or has led in the past, to a certain amount of log rolling. You know, you can't hire your relatives for DOT, so you get some other department to hire them. But, you know, when you hire one of their relatives. And I mean, that kind of stuff has gone on in the past, but at least make it look good.
Instead of a lottery-based policy, perhaps a Keno-based policy?
That would be good. Just go down to Chuck E. Cheese and put your numbers in and see what summer job you got.
A last thing for you, Keith. You were just writing about something. Lest we spend too much time talking about the Democrats that overwhelmingly run this state and what they're doing at the Capitol, you just wrote about the Republicans. You know, the Mirror found 15 instances of state Republicans praising back home the funding that they opposed in Hartford. This is one of the funny things we see, of course.
Sure.
Spending's terrible unless it's spending in my town.
And that we didn't have to look back very far. We just looked basically since the session ended. And when the Republicans come home, sometimes it's just this is wonderful money. It's a great use of state money. Sometimes it even goes a little further. We found one representative who back home talked about how he had pressed for the bill that brought town aid, road repair grants to his town. Well, he voted against the bill. He wasn't even on the committee that approved the bill. One of my favorite things was a picture we had of State Senator Art Linares, who's a freshman, a Republican from Westbrook, campaigned against all the wasteful state spending, but still stopped to take a picture with Governor O'Neill's widow, Nikki O'Neill, at this new gazebo being built in his district. I guess that one wasn't as wasteful.
Speaking of wasteful state spending, Christine, a last thing for you. We got a number of complaints, people who were concerned that I didn't spend any time yesterday talking to the governor about this damn busway project. We've got to stop it. We have to stop this busway from being built, this boondoggle. You just took a tour of the busway. It doesn't seem like it's going to be stopped being built anytime soon, right?
No, the busway is not going to be stopped. It is probably about 50% built at the moment. The stations are going up and most of the roadway is paved and they're putting some drainage in, and the Flatbush station in Hartford should be open by December 1st.
And so you took a little tour. If you go to ctnewsjunkie.com, you can actually see Christine driving down the busway.
Yes, yes.
Was it pretty exciting?
No, I mean, it was fine.
It was fine.
It was a little bumpy, but I'm sure they'll get all the kinks
smoothed out. Can you say damn busway on the radio? Isn't it darn busway?
Yeah, I think it's darn busway.
Okay.
To heck with you, Keith Vanoff. Keith Vanoff from the Connecticut Mirror, thank you so much for joining us.
I really
appreciate it. Thanks also to Christine Stewart, the editor of ctnewsjunkie.com. Thank you, Christine.
Thank you.
Now, when we come back, Colin McEnroe and I will talk to David Folkenflik from NPR. He's been covering media for years, and he's been covering his own network far too much. The CEO and president of NPR is once again stepping down. We'll look at the future of our network coming up next, Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on tomorrow's show, we've talked about warming waters before. Now they're back in the news. Flourishing bacteria in some Connecticut shellfish have made people sick. We'll look at some recent challenges in the Connecticut shellfish industry. We'll also check in on climate studies and look at making the best of a different kind of warm water problem, shark tourism on the Cape. That and more coming up on tomorrow's Where We Live. Today, it's our weekly news roundtable, The Wheelhouse. We're joined by WNPR's Colin McEnroe. And, 2 days ago, some surprising news came out of National Public Radio, NPR. Less than 2 years after taking the helm of NPR, President and CEO Gary Nell announced that he's leaving the network to lead the National Geographic Society. Joining us to talk about his departure and its impact on member stations, on the entire NPR product, is David Folkenflik. He's NPR's media correspondent. He joins us by phone. Welcome back to the show, David. Thanks for being here.
Hey, John. Always good to talk with you.
So, first of all, David, I was watching my Twitter feed and all of my friends from public radio and in Washington on Facebook, and to a person, every single person seemed shocked. Were you surprised at this announcement by Gary Nell?
Absolutely. I mean, there was no trigger to this except for the second half of the equation, which is that he's being hired by the National Geographic Society, an outfit that we think of because perhaps of the magazine. magazine or the TV channel, but, you know, it's an enormous educational media publishing television and conservation outfit with a global footprint. It's got perhaps a less Byzantine funding structure. It's partly grounded in the television industry from which Gary Nell came. He came, after all, after 13 years at Sesame Workshop, the people behind Sesame Street. And before that, he had worked at WNET here in New York City, you know, the nation's largest, I believe, public television station. So, you know, he saw this as an opportunity to go to a bigger outfit. He said he was intending, his contract was up at the end of November. He was intending to re-up for a longer contract. He just initially signed a two-year deal to start with NPR, and that this came along as a surprise, but that since he couldn't dictate the timing, he thought it was too good a deal to pass up.
And when you say too good a deal to pass up, I mean, not to put too fine a point on it, but I believe he took a bit of a pay cut to move from his previous job at Sesame Workshop to come head up NPR. The previous head of National Geographic made something like $1.4 million a year. It seems as though, David, he's in line for maybe about a $1 million raise. That's something that I think a lot of us in public radio would say, all right, I guess I'd take that gig too.
Well, I don't think Gary will step into the exactly the $1.4 million territory at the moment he arrives. But, yeah, I think that's probably basically right. He made, from what any external review might think as a rational personal choice. That said, you know, look, a lot of people were very startled and even quite distressed by this. NPR, as you suggested in your introduction, has had a lot of turnover. By my count, Gary Nell's successor will be the seventh, you know, acting or permanent CEO NPR has had in the previous little more than, call it, 7 years. That's too much turnover, even if, as in this case, the transition is not one triggered by conflict with the board, conflict with the stations, any national controversies or scandals as occurred under Vivian Schiller. This is not that scenario at all. I think people are upset in most part because they feel he's been doing a good job. He's soothed these choppy waters and made people feel, okay, grown-ups are in charge. The executives are working together. The stations are working collaboratively with the system as a whole. And, you know, they don't want that disturbed, quite understandably.
David Collin here with a question. To the listeners, probably the one thing that they would know about Gary Nell, either to their delight or to their disappointment, would be the elimination of Talk of the Nation and the substitution of Here and Now, at least on a lot of the stations that used to carry that in the afternoon. That's, of course, a big visible programming change that could be traced to or associated with him. But, you know, behind the scenes, I think people wonder, well, is NPR the kind of thing that kind of runs itself? You got people who've been there for hundreds of years. They know what they're doing. What does the CEO do, and how big an impact can a CEO have on an institution like NPR?
I actually think that's a great question, and I go around talking a lot to member stations, had a great visit there with you guys not so long ago, and people wonder about that. I mean, I can answer it basically in two seemingly contradictory ways that are almost complementary. One is which is that regardless of the leadership and even amid the tumult, NPR was doing its journalism all along. I've been at NPR since fall of 2004, and no point have I seen a CEO reach down and try somehow to affect the journalism. You know, the ways in which it's affected are twofold, one of which is that there's the question of budgeting, the question of, you know, what kind of money do we have to do what kinds of journalism, and then you've got certain kinds of macro philosophy and policy, you know, but I would say to a person, you know, perhaps to slightly varying degrees, but to a person, the CEOs have said, you know, our calling card has been the kind of textured, in-depth reporting from places near and places quite distant, you know, around the world as well as around the country to a degree almost unmatched by any American, you know, news broadcaster or major newspaper you know, that listeners expect that for us and that they've been not only protective of but champions for, both with donors, with underwriters, with member stations, and, you know, with the, shall we say, government agencies that help to subsidize primarily our member stations, not, you know, the directly NPR itself.
To this question that Colin asked about the role of the CEO, let's listen to a bit from Gary Nell in his interview with David Folkenflik just the other day.
Morning Edition will come on the air at 5 a.m. tomorrow morning, hell or high water, and the day after and the day after that. This is a very strong organization. It's way bigger than, frankly, a CEO.
And that's Gary Nell talking about that role that the CEO plays. But you mentioned some of the financial pressures that a CEO does have, David. And this is part of the story of NPR. It's been made certainly known to the public. There's been some stories written about in the Washington Post about NPR's brand new fancy headquarters unveiling at a time in which, you know, there's an awful lot of fiscal turmoil. Maybe you can talk about the financial health of NPR right now, what Gary Nell leaves behind, a lot of which he inherited himself.
Well, so look, I mean, part of this is the residue of certain kinds of underwriting and other issues that have affected stations since the great, you know, recession that we've experienced in this country. And the network is trying to make some financial decisions. NPR cited some of the financial constraints it had in the decision to drop Talk of the Nation after so many years, a show that I enjoyed appearing on and enjoyed listening to myself even prior to joining NPR. But we said as a network that it would be a way to save some money, and it was also a way to show collaboration with the stations that we had been hearing feedback, you know, that there was a need to have a vehicle for doing more breaking news and more imminent news over the course of the day with perhaps slightly shorter form treatment, and here now is the effort to fill that. But, you know, that is not on its own going to take care of the major budget gap. There's about a $6 million deficit through the end of the current fiscal year, which is actually done on a basis, so it's at the end of September, and there's a larger one for next year. Now, these are significant amounts, $6 million on a, let's say, back of the envelope on $180 million, you know, is not 5%, but it's, you know, a significant amount. It's likely to be more next year. And, you know, we're told by executives that they're going to have to make some tough choices, but they want to do it in a way that protects the core of what NPR is doing. If you look at the Washington Post is losing money and is on a direction to lose more money increasingly over time. At NPR, they say, look, we can't afford to do every single thing we're doing, but we believe that, you know, with some trims and a couple of probably painful cuts that I don't know what are yet, because they haven't been approved, that we're going to be okay. And those are financial realities. It's a strong network that is, to my mind, increasingly vital to the ecosystem for the country. But, you know, at the same time, with some real challenges.
You know, David, obviously we're getting very excited about the coronation of our eighth CEO in 8 years.
Oh, sure.
And so there's inside candidates and there's outside candidates. And, you know, one thing we haven't quickly mentioned all that much is the challenges to a strictly radio format. NPR, of course, and even in its branding, moved away from that. You've got a digital revolution unfolding that's going to change listening habits. You've got smartphones, you've got Stitcher, you've got new platforms. Is that kind of an argument once again to go outside and get somebody who's not strictly radio?
Well, I think you've seen the last two permanent CEOs have been people who have had extensive media experience outside radio. Vivian Schiller, for whatever her flaws as a CEO and as a public face for NPR, was well thought of. She had been a senior executive at CNN. She had been the person over the joint television venture between Discovery Television and the New York Times when they had Discovery Times Television for a while there. She was the general manager, if I'm remembering her title correctly, at nytimes.com. And so she understood the digital space. She understood newspapers. She understood cable television. Gary Nell, you know, you think of Sesame Workshop, what we used to call when I was a kid, Children's Television Workshop, you know, as the nice guys behind Bert and Ernie, and they certainly are, but they also, you know, had financial deals allowing them operations in more than 100 countries across the world. They had an incredibly robust digital presence. You know, they were maintaining the strength of their core business, which was television, a not-for-profit business, but a business nonetheless, and yet they were doing all these innovative things beside. One of the things that I think is interesting is even as we think of NPR at times as a soft-spoken, understated player in the media realm, and there's certainly some truth to that, the stuff that our colleagues are doing digitally and with apps is considered consistently some of the most innovative stuff in media among major news organizations. And I can tell you, when I talk to leaders, they often cite NPR as an institution that is innovating, that is experimental, that is doing the best it can to figure out ways to work with its audience more directly, even as we have the complicating Byzantine and at times incredibly important relationship that we have through our stations and through, you know, the old-fashioned radio signals.
And we got to leave it there with David Folkenflik, media correspondent for NPR. Thanks also to Colin McEnroe. This is The Wheelhouse on Where We Live.